Hello, and welcome to Primary Viewpoints, a monthly podcast that features informative conversations with healthcare experts, opinion leaders, and practicing physicians about what impacts primary care medicine today. I'm your host, Sydney Jennings, editor with Patient Care Online, and in this episode, we sat down with Dr. Samoon Ahmad, a clinical professor of psychiatry at New York University Grossman School of Medicine, who has written about human coping and resilience in the aftermath of disasters. Ahmad discusses how his own eerie sense of desolation during the early weeks of the COVID-19 pandemic lockdown sparked his thinking about and then concentrated research into the potential social-cultural consequences of a prolonged COVID-19 era. Ahmad was infected with SARS-CoV-2 in March 2020, and during his quarantine and extended recovery began to organize his research. The project evolved into his most recent book, Coping with COVID-19, The Mental, Medical, and Social Consequences of the Pandemic, which will be available this April.
And what was your, I'm curious what your inspiration was for a project of this scope, but really covering any potential sequelae of the pandemic. It's a huge undertaking.
Right. That's I would say understatement. Yes, correct. You know, I think a large part of it was seeing the impact of the pandemic in New York City during the spring of 2020. This rolling count at the bottom of the television screens on every news network and this constant coverage in the press felt surreal. Mm-hmm. But seeing this emptiness of Manhattan in March 2020 firsthand shook me in a way that I wasn't really totally expecting. It was like being, as I say in my book, Will Smith in I Am Legend, you know? I could stand in the middle of the First Avenue and not see a car in sight. And perhaps this this feeling of desolation would have been, I would say, less impactful in a suburban setting, but being so used to the the streets in New York when in the middle of the avenue at rush hour and not seeing another soul around you is sort of a very eerie feeling. And it really hit me how far reaching the effects of the pandemic were going to be. And I realized that we were going to be battling what I call as two distinct problems, the SARS-CoV-2 virus and the pandemic as a sociological phenomenon. Now, I would say in the case of the former, I felt confident that the medical community would come around and somehow we would learn how to better treat COVID-19, develop preventive medicines and vaccines that would boost our immunity or at the very least improve patient prognosis. But and to be honest, these things have happened, even though the virus keeps throwing a curveball at us, you know, at this stage. However, in the case of the latter, somehow I lacked that same level of confidence. I had no idea how the shutdown and this months of isolation would affect millions, if not billions of people. And, you know, as I look back in the wake of September 11th, certainly the largest, I should say, mass tragedy I've experienced personally, at least you could be with your family, or you could be with your friends. And most people, you know, went back to work or within a few days, or they were going to school. And these kinds of, I should say, support networks that have been a part of human story since, I could say, well before recorded history, were still intact. But the problem is with the pandemic, certainly, we were completely cut off from these groups that were integral to our social and personal identities. And many people certainly had nothing to do and nowhere to go and no one to talk to. So one cannot underestimate the impact of such significant psychological trauma. And then I got COVID and I was asked to quarantine at home for 2 weeks. And though I was lucky that I didn't experience the full-blown sequel of symptoms and were not as severe, but the disease did take a toll on my body and it took weeks to recover from a lingering cough and fatigue. And I'm a very active guy who likes to bike and run and exercise and this, and I was you know, telling my wife about 9 months into it, I said, after 8-9 months, I felt my endurance level had come back to where it was. That is the time span. And I wasn't even hit that severe. So I could just imagine what's it like. And, you know, what happened was during that time of quarantine, I was so sort of struggling with not having structure, not being able to go to work, that I started delving into the origin, the source, the pathology, this transmission of the virus. And I kept finding myself going down this, what I call as a rabbit hole, the rabbit hole that kept on branching into different directions as I dug deeper and deeper. And whatnot, and the most interesting thing was one could not even find good objective scientific information in one place. And I had to search all over. And if I, as a physician, had this problem, I couldn't even imagine how a lay person would find and digest this information. I just started to realize, and it cemented in my mind how severe and long lasting the lingering, what I call as economic, psychological, and psychosocial impacts were going to be. And I would say this was a major impetus to write the book and bringing all the scientific information in one place. And secondly, moreover, to discuss the psychological and social consequences, which will probably, I would say, continue to linger for a long time. So sort of that's how I would tell you what the impetus was for the book.
Right, right. So you point out in the introduction and at other places in the book too, that the majority of us will in fact recover from our COVID-19 experience over time and as we're able, each on our own timeline, but not everybody will. And you note that we as a society need to be vigilant for the signs and symptoms of people who are continuing or for ongoing disturbance. And I'm thinking of primary care physicians who are truly on the front line with their panel of patients every day, the average patient who comes and goes. What should they be more sensitive to or for on a daily basis than they were before the pandemic?
I think clinicians definitely need to be more sensitive to many physical and psychological issues, or most importantly, be looking for signs of, substance use disorders. A lot of people used food or alcohol or cannabis or other drugs to cope with the stresses of the pandemic. And there's nothing as dangerous about using some of these substances in moderation and on occasions. However, the frequent use of these drugs, alcohol and isolation, is a recipe for disaster and trouble, to be honest. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know if you're familiar, but there was an excellent article, if I remember correctly, in The Atlantic by her name is Kate Julian. And she discussed how humanity is no stranger to alcohol. And, you know, in fact, it has historically been used to strengthen social bonds and to celebrate. But here's the big but. What is relatively new and problematic, in my opinion, is this phenomenon of drinking alone, which can quickly go from a sort of a minor crutch to the activity which one bases their whole day upon. And especially when a person has certainly no social obligations to tend to. And furthermore, I should say being in isolation makes it easier to deny how serious any abuse has become to others and to yourself. And this is especially important if there is no one around to check on you and see or observe the change in your behavior, your self-care, and your daily routine. Right. But, you know, the important thing is, talking about clinicians, the body doesn't lie. There are clinical signs. Liver inflammation, you know, you can check for those things. You can do blood work with it. And I think primary care practitioners should be looking for these kind of things. But, you know, more importantly, I want to talk about the white elephant in the room. One of the most important and far less discussed, even as of today, or mentioned issues in the press or media, is the general overall health of the public with record levels of obesity and chronic medical issues that are in most cases preventable, to be honest. And besides the known risk factors, including age, weight, gender, and most recently, this data came out a few days ago of looking on this particular gene that has just been found that doubles your risk of developing COVID in South Africa. Most of the other conditions that we talk about, the preventable ones, they predispose people to inflammation. And when people develop these conditions, you can develop life-threatening consequences of COVID. And right. Now, on top of it, with the lockdown happening, a lot of people either stop exercising or it significantly reduced the amount that they move around during the day, which may manifest as weight gain and put patients at risk of more metabolic disorders, type 2 diabetes, dyslipidemia, which increases your risk of heart attacks, stroke, and COVID complications, as I mentioned earlier. Right. Now, you know, the important thing as clinicians, at least I have felt as even as a psychiatrist, that broaching this subject can be quite difficult because no one likes to hear, whether if the patient's not, that it looks like they have gained unhealthy weight. But I think, you know, if we have to do our duty, it's important that clinicians advise their patients to do their best to engage in even modest and some sort of an exercise routine. And in addition to helping them with weight management, exercise can help relieve stress and improve mood. And let me define exercise. I don't mean going to the gym and pumping iron and being on a treadmill. I am talking about being active. Get out, walk, get fresh air, move around, take small steps daily, and it can have a positive effect on your health. And needless to say, such activity, we know, boosts immunity and as well as have positive psychological effects. And I think we should be more aware as clinicians of one's living situation. We should inquire about their mental and physical health. You know, for example, living solitary lifestyle is by no means a bad thing in itself, but loneliness, you know, which is undesired social isolation, can really adversely affect our patients' health. So if I'm a clinician at the front lines, primary care, I would inquire into their experience during the pandemic, whether they've spent the majority of their time alone or with others. And if I'm doing a psych evaluation and found out the patient spends most of their time pandemic alone, I would consider, in fact, even trying to obtain family or collateral information to see, are you noticing any behavioral changes compared to what you see in this individual, your loved one, you know? And additionally, I would inquire into stress-related symptoms, which can be a brief screening in the primary care clinic. Just general things. Are you more irritable? Do you feel sort of losing your cool more frequently, more aggressive? You feel tired? Do you have any physical discomforts like psychosomatic symptoms, headaches, upset stomach, skin problems, GI problems, menstrual problems, sleep problems? And sleep, I need to make it bold and underline, because having a sleep difficulty, which has been widely reported throughout the pandemic, so many people complain, often occurs in conjunction with mood disorders like depression and predisposes people to condition, adds to their physical ailments and lowers their immunity. So I would say pay special attention to those factors. And finally, one last point I want to say is, I think the clinicians need to be more attuned to the symptoms of long COVID going forward. Mm. Because understandably, most of us are focused on the Omicron surge right now. But once it passes, I think clinicians are going to be overwhelmed, in my opinion, by the number of patients who have non-specific symptoms linked to COVID, long COVID, I should say. As of now, you know, data just came out, there are estimated 100 million cases of long COVID worldwide. And these could be, there could be, I should say, tens of millions more in the coming months. And we still don't fully understand the etiology of the conditions, though there's a very interesting theory being developed right now by researchers in South Africa about microclots developing in the vessels that are leading to this these issues. However, you know, talking about the etiology of the condition, the full range of treatment, the prognosis, first we need to develop diagnostic tests and then we can move on from there. We don't even have the diagnostic tests for it. And in the best case scenario, I think the researchers will be sort of shift their attention to the condition and we'll discover some effective condition. But the worst case scenario, there'll be millions of people flooding our healthcare system who are struggling with symptoms, and we still don't know what to do with them. And I think either way, it's going to take a massive toll on our healthcare system in the coming months and years. So many clinicians, you know, sort of when people come and complain about vague symptoms, you sort of blow them out. You know, it's like, there's nothing acute about it. Go away. This. No, I would actually screen them very diligently to see what is happening. And so they could be followed up, because many of these people with long-lasting COVID are developing psychological, psychiatric, and people don't realize at times that these psychological, psychiatric comorbidities translate into societal, social issues. They won't have a job. They're going to be out of workplace. You'll have shortages of overall workforce. You could have financial problems for the families. Children will be suffering. There's a whole cascade, a mushroom cloud that's going to develop. So that's a long answer to your question, but that's how I see it.
And it made me think too, when you were talking about the physician observing his 26th patient that week with these vague symptoms that he doesn't really understand, how are medical professionals themselves going to need to cope going forward? You being one.
Yeah, me being one is right. You know, medical professionals have been challenged, you know, throughout the pandemic and before, you know, but because of the pandemic, and it's like a relentless the nature of these surges and waves that are coming at them. There's no break. You know, burnout is quite a clear and present danger to physicians and nurses at all times. The hours are long and you witness a host of sickness, tragedy, and death. And in this particular case, they were not just clinicians. They were the only people allowed at the deathbed. They were proxy parents. They were proxy children. They were proxy brother and sister. They had to walk so many fine lines of being with the people. I can't imagine how many of my colleagues who have come in private, sat down in my office and broken down, that how many deaths they have seen today in the midst of the surges at this point. You know, it is not easy psychologically, you know, but in the past, at least you could catch your bearings, take a break and return to work being refreshed. With COVID, we have had just fewer moments of respite and struggled with this constant stress of worrying about either self becoming infected, you know, and myself actually being infected and then infecting our families. And, you know, and should we be going home? Should we be living in a hotel, being separated from this? And we can't underestimate that kind of stress that you are living under day by day. So coping with this, I should say, added stress will require more than just rest and relaxation. And I think medical institutions, hospitals can do a lot more by promoting stress reduction programs rather than having the staff seek these programs on their own. I also think that finding someone to talk to who has shared the experience, whether it's a friend who happens to be a healthcare provider or a licensed therapist, can go a long way. And in fact, you know, at the hospital that I've been working at, they did an amazing thing. They implemented what is known as a battle buddy program for frontline workers. And this is something that has existed in the U.S. Army for some time now, and it encourages people to talk to their peers and keep them from bottling up their emotions and prevents self-isolation. So this is one way to build resilience, I should say, and help clinicians cope better with everyday stress, which, to be honest, does not seem to be lessening anytime soon. But I think this is such an important point for people, because burnout is burnout. But I think most people don't realize, even other specialties don't, from non-psychiatric perspective, that burnout eventually will predispose you to depression and other conditions and prevent you from performing your job and even interfere with your relationships in the long run. So I think that's why these are some of the strategies that need to be implemented.